Okay, let's unpack this. We're talking about a tennis legend who just keeps rewriting the record books, right? Someone whose dominance on the court is, well, almost matched by the conversations he sparks way beyond it. We're talking about a player who, even after decades at the very top, continues to define what's possible in sport.
It's quite something.
I mean, just last year, 2024, he achieved something truly monumental, grabbing that singles gold medal at the Paris Olympics.
Yeah, the missing piece, finally.
Exactly. And that victory didn't just add another trophy. It completed both a career Golden Slam and a career Super Slam. Just incredible.
And you'd think, okay, maybe he slows down after that.
We would think, but no, just this year, 2025, he hits his 100th ATP singles title,
At Geneva.
making him the first player ever to win at least one ATP title in 20 consecutive seasons. 20.
It's astonishing, really. That kind of longevity, that relentless ambition. It's Djokovic.
What's truly fascinating here, and I think our sources really bear this out, is how his journey, from a childhood forged in war-torn Serbia to the recent Olympic gold in the Century of Titles, it isn't just a straight line of athletic success.
No, not at all. It's this like complex tapestry, isn't it?
Clear.
Woven with these deeply held personal convictions, these moments of defiance. And then there's the statistical dominance that just forces us to rethink what's possible in tennis.
Right. It's a story of constant evolution. You feel not just in his game, but in his whole persona.
Definitely.
Absolutely. So today, our deep dive is all about Novak Djokovic, the man, the champion, and yeah, maybe the enigma too. We've pulled together a really rich stack of sources, articles, research, personal accounts covering pretty much his entire career, his personal life, those staggering achievements.
Yeah.
And yes, the controversies and unique viewpoints that have, sometimes made him such a compelling and sometimes polarizing figure.
And our mission today really is to go beyond just the headlines and the match results. We want to try and distill the most important bits of knowledge, the key insights from all this material, to give you, our listener, a kind of shortcut to being genuinely well-informed about this titan of tennis.
Yeah, exactly. We'll explore the incredible arc of his career. We'll delve into that unique playing style that makes him so successful.
Analyze those epic rivalries that really defined an era.
Right, the big three battles. And importantly, unpack those off-court aspects that make him such a complex and honestly, endlessly compelling individual.
So where do we start? To really understand the champion he became, you have to go back.
Yeah, absolutely. Back to the beginning. Let's look at the crucible that forged him.
Indeed. Novak Djokovic was born May 22, 1987, in Belgrade. That was SR Serbia, SFR Yugoslavia back then. His family background is paternal Serbian, maternal Croatian. And it's interesting, his two younger brothers, Marko and Djordje, they also played pro tennis.
Oh, I didn't realize both brothers played professionally too, though obviously not quite at his level.
No, not quite at that stratospheric level, no. But tennis was clearly in the family.
And his own start in tennis was incredibly early, wasn't it? Our sources say he was just four.
4 years old, yeah. His parents gave him a mini racket, a soft foam ball, and his father, Surgeon, apparently called it the most beloved toy in his life.
Wow. Imagine that little toy sparking a passion that would like fundamentally change a sport. It's almost cliché, but with such unique layers beneath it.
It is. And from that moment, the path wasn't, smooth sailing. The early coaching, the immense sacrifices his family made, it's a critical part of the story. For 6 years, 93 to 99, he was coached by Jelena Genicic.
Right, at Mount Kopanonik, where his parents had that fast food place.
Exactly. And Genicic wasn't just about technique. She was apparently key in shaping his game, convincing him to go with a two-handed backhand instead of the one-hander like his idol, Pete Sampras.
That's a huge decision early on.
Massive. And Djokovic himself credits her for, quote, "shaping my mind as a human being, but also as a professional." That tells you a lot about her influence.
It really does. More than just hitting balls. It sounds like she was building character, resilience, maybe.
I think so.
Yeah.
And the sacrifices just ramped up from there. At 12, just 12, he moves to Germany.
To the Pilich Academy, right. In September 99, spent 4 years there.
4 crucial years, yeah. And Nikola Pilich, a really renowned coach, he didn't just teach him strokes. The sources talk about this rigorous training, having Novak serve against a wall for months to perfect his technique.
Months. Just against a wall.
Months. And working with a rubber exercise band for a whole year just for wrist flexibility. It sounds incredibly disciplined, almost monastic.
Grueling. And all this is happening against a really tough backdrop, right? The Yugoslav wars.
Absolutely cannot ignore that context. The late 90s, Serbia enduring embargoes, yeah. NATO bombings during the Kosovo War. Djokovic has talked about training inside a disused swimming pool that they'd converted into a makeshift court just to find somewhere safe to hit balls.
Wow.
And then there's the financial strain. His father taking out high-interest loans to pay for it all. Huge pressure on young Novak.
And he feels that pressure actually helped him.
He believes so, yeah. He thinks that relentless early pressure directly honed his ability to perform in clutch moments later on.
Yeah.
It kind of forged that mental steel.
So those early years, it wasn't just about the forehand and backhand. It was fundamentally shaping his mindset, his fight. And even before turning pro, his junior career was pretty stellar, wasn't it? Like a preview of what was coming.
Oh, definitely. 2001, he just dominated the under-14s, won titles in Italy, beating Andy Murray in one semifinal.
Ah, the first signs of that rivalry.
Exactly. Won the U14 European champs, singles and doubles, led Serbia to the European Summer Cup win, ended 2001 ranked number one in U14 Europe, with Murray number two. Fascinating, right?
Really is, setting the stage early.
And he kept it going in U16s in 2002. Won tournaments in France, beat Gael Monfils in one final, won his first ITF title too. His overall junior record was solid, 40-11 singles, 23-6 doubles. Got to number 24 in the world junior rankings in early 04.
And reached the Aussie Open junior semis that year too.
He did, clearly signaling he was ready for the next step.
Okay, so a really strong foundation built under these incredibly tough character-defining circumstances, that sets the stage perfectly for his professional ascent, which, you know, wasn't instant superstardom, was it? It was more of a steady climb from 2003 to 2010.
Very steady, yeah. He turned pro in 2003, played his first Futures match, lost narrowly, but won his first Futures title later that year in Belgrade. Ended 2003 ranked, what, 687?
Right, starting from the ground up.
Then 2004, he gets his first official ATP win in Davis Cup. Wins his first challenger title in Budapest on his 17th birthday. Ends that year ranked 186. Patiently building.
It's that incremental climb, isn't it? Not bursting onto the scene like some others. Grand Slam debut in 2005 at the Aussie Open.
Mm-hmm.
Gets his first actual slam win at the French Open that year. And by the end of 05, he cracks the top 100, number 78, youngest player in there.
Which is a huge milestone, breaking that top 100 barrier.
Definitely. And during this time, 2006, there was that interesting little detail about potentially playing for Great Britain.
Ah, yes, that story. The media reported his family discussed it. Djokovic initially kind of brushed it off, but later confirmed there were serious talks. But he emphasized he chose Serbia because of his strong national identity.
Mm.
And that decision, looking back, feels very significant, right?
Mm.
Given everything that followed.
It really does. Underlines that patriotism, that conviction we see later. Also in 2006, the French Open, he really makes a mark. Reaches his first Grand Slam quarterfinal.
Yeah, beat Fernando Gonzalez, who was seeded ninth.
Had to retire against Nadal in that QF with an injury, but that was their first meeting, wasn't it? The start of something huge.
The very beginning of that epic rivalry. And that run pushed him into the top 40.
And he built on that momentum, didn't he? Won his first ATP titles that year.
He did. Dutch Open in Amersfoort, then the Moselle Open in Metz. Broke into the top 20, ended 2006 ranked 16th, youngest in the top 20. He wasn't just promising anymore. He was a real threat.
Okay, so he's making serious waves. But 2007 and 2008... those feel like the real breakthrough years where he plants his flag in the top three?
Absolutely. 2007, starts strong, wins Adelaide, runner-up in Indian Wells, then wins Miami.
His first Masters title. And the youngest champ there since Agassi in 1990. Beat Nadal and Kanyas, too. That's a statement.
Huge statement. His confidence was clearly growing. Won Estoril on clay, reached his first major semi at the French Open, lost to Nadal again, but getting closer. Retired in the Wimbledon semis against Nadal with that elbow issue. But then came the Canadian Open.
Oh, yes. That was spectacular.
Unbelievable run. Beat world number three Roddick, number two Nadal, and number one Federer. All in the same tournament.
Wow. First player to do that since Becker in 94.
Exactly. And Bjorn Borg himself said Djokovic was definitely a contender to win a Grand Slam. High praise indeed.
And he backed it up. Reached his first major final at the U.S. Open that year. Lost to Federer, but he was there.
Yep. Won Vienna, too. Finished the year ranked number three. Firmly in the elite group. The stage was absolutely set for 2008.
Which was the year everything changed, really.
Monumental year. Started with Hopman Cup, even played Serena Williams in mixed doubles there.
Ah, fun fact.
But the real story was the Australian Open. Reached the final without dropping a single set. Incredible form. Then the semifinal against Federer, the two-time defending champ. And Djokovic beats him.
A huge upset at the time.
Massive.
Mm.
And then he goes on to beat Joe Wilfried Tsonga in the final to win his first Grand Slam singles title. That broke the Federer-Nadal stranglehold they'd won the previous 11 majors straight. This was a clear signal. The duopoly was over. A new force had arrived.
He wasn't just winning. He was disrupting the entire narrative of that era. And he kept winning big titles that year, too.
Yep. More Masters success. Won Indian Wells and the Italian Open, his third and fourth Masters titles. Grabbed a bronze medal in singles at the Beijing Olympics, too.
Right, adding that Olympic hardware.
And then capped off an amazing year by winning his first year-end championship, the Tennis Masters Cup in Shanghai, beating Gavi Danko. He was consolidating his spot, not just a challenger, but someone who could win the biggest events against the best. This really set the tone for what was coming next.
Okay, so the next couple of years, 09 and 10, he's maintaining that high level, right? Maybe not quite the historic dominance yet, but still winning a lot.
Exactly, consolidating. 2009, he reached 10 finals, won 5 titles. Dubai, the first ever Serbia Open winning at home, was big for him. Reached finals in Monte Carlo, Rome, lost to Nadal both times. Cincinnati final, beat Nadal in the semis, lost to Fed. He was consistently in the mix.
Right there, knocking on the door.
2010 was interesting. Defended his Dubai title. And a huge moment, leading Serbia to his first ever Davis Cup title.
That must have been massive for him and the country.
Huge. A real moment of national pride. But it was also a year of maybe slight turbulence. Split with coach Todd Martin and had that really rare loss at the French Open quarters to Jürgen Meltzer after being up 2 sets to love.
Which is incredible. That's still his only major loss from 2 sets up, right?
That's the stat, yeah.
Yeah.
Just shows his mental strength usually. He also won his first ATP doubles title that year too. Showcasing the all-around game.
So we've seen this steady climb, this consolidation, but then comes this period, roughly 2011 to 2016, that just feels like total dominance, the reign of dominance, the Knoll slam. What clicked? What changed?
Yeah, this era fundamentally shifted everything in men's tennis. And 2011, well, 2011 wasn't just great. It was one of the great seasons ever.
Yeah.
He starts absolutely on fire. Wins the Australian Open, his second, beats Federer in the semis, Murray in the final, showing he can beat both rivals at the slams.
Right.
Then he just sweeps Dubai, Indian Wells, Miami, becomes only the third guy ever to beat both Fed and Rafa in the same event twice. And it wasn't just that he was winning, it was how. Beating them repeatedly, even on their best surfaces. It signaled he wasn't just a contender anymore, he was the guy.
It felt like a psychological shift as much as a technical one.
Completely. And then the clay court breakthrough that year, that was huge.
Beating Nadal on clay after losing 9 straight.
Exactly. Won Serbia Open, then Madrid and Rome, beating Rafa in straight sets in both finals. Massive mental barrier overcome. That led into this incredible 43-match win streak. A perfect 41-0 start to the season.
Just insane. Until the French Open semis against Federer, right?
Yeah, Fed snapped the streak there. But Novak bounced back incredibly quickly. 5 weeks later, wins his first Wimbledon title.
Beating Nadal in the final again, and that secured the world number one ranking for the first time.
Climbing the mountain, then followed up by beating Nadal again in the U.S. Open final. His first U.S. Open title, third major of 2011. Just a dominant breakthrough year.
Absolutely phenomenal. Truly one for the ages. So moving into 2012, 2013, he keeps that momentum going, especially down under, and keeps chipping away at Rafa's clay dominance.
Yes. 2012 kicks off with that legendary Australian Open final against Nadal.
The marathon, 5 hours, 53 minutes.
Longest major final ever. Longest match in Aussie Open history. And Djokovic wins it. Just incredible physical and mental endurance on display. He also won Miami again, reached his first French Open final, lost to Nadal their definitive Rogers Cup title, and won the ATP finals again at the end of the year. Still operating at an elite level.
And 2013, another Aussie Open title. Right. Made it 3 in a row.
Record third consecutive in the Open era. Yeah. Beat Murray in that final. But maybe even more impressive that year, showing his versatility, was winning the Monte Carlo Masters.
Right. Beating Nadal there, ending Rafa's incredible 46-match win streak at that specific tournament.
Huge statement. Proving he could win anywhere, even on Nadal's fortress.
He lost some tough slam finals that year, though, didn't he?
He did. Dramatic French Open semi to Nadal, Wimbledon final to Murray, U.S. Open final to Nadal. But he finished 2013 incredibly strong. Won China, Shanghai, Paris Masters, and the ATP World Tour Finals. Ended the year on a 24-match winning streak.
Which led to bringing Boris Becker onto the team.
Yeah, Becker joined as head coach for 2014, signaled a real push to find that next level, that extra edge.
So 2014, 2015, more Wimbledon battles, right. Crazy Masters success. His grip on number one just tightens.
Definitely. 2014 wins Indian Wells in Miami again, the Sunshine Double.
Right.
beats Nadal at the Italian Open, and this is where he donated his entire $500,000 prize money to flood victims in Southeast Europe. A really powerful moment.
Yeah, connecting his success back home, a consistent theme.
Absolutely. He lost the French final to Nadal again, but then got redemption at Wimbledon, won his second title, beating Federer in a five-set classic.
Reclaiming world number one, too.
Yep. Finished the year winning his fifth China Open, Paris Masters, secured year-end number one for the third time. Mm-hmm. Just relentless consistency.
And then 2015, our sources describe it as just historic, almost suffocating dominance.
It really was. Won a record fifth Australian Open, beating Murray again, became the first player to win the Indian Wells Miami double three times, then won Monte Carlo, becoming the first man to win the first three Masters 1000s of the season, then won Rome. Four Masters titles out of the first four he played. He was just on another planet.
Unstoppable. Until the French Open final, right? The Wawrinka upset.
That was a shocker, yeah.
Yeah.
Stan played lights out. But Novak bounced right back, won his third Wimbledon, beating Federer, then won the U.S. Open, beating Federer again. That was the third Grand Slam in 2015, 10th overall.
And statistically, that was his best ever season.
By the numbers, yes. Reached a record 15 consecutive finals, won a record 10 big titles, slams, masters, ATP finals, got a record 31 wins over top 10 players.
Yeah.
That big title sweep across all the major events, it's just unparalleled versatility and dominance. Statistical marvel.
15 consecutive finals. That level of consistency is mind-bending. Which brings us to 2016, the year of the Knoll Slam and the career Grand Slam, the peak of the mountain.
Truly the pinnacle. Started 2016 winning his 60th career title in Doha, beating Nadal, then claims his sixth Australian Open, beating Fed in semis, Murray in the final. Wins his fifth Indian Wells, sixth Miami Open, tying Agassi's record there, achieved his fourth Sunshine double, most ever.
He became the all-time prize money leader then too, right?
Yep. Crossed $98.2 million. Uh-huh. Just shows how much winning he was doing.
And it all built towards Paris.
The holy grail for him at that point. Won Madrid, then came the French Open, beat Murray in four sets in the final. And with that victory, he completed the Knoll Slam, holding all four major titles at the same time.
First man since Rod Laver in 1969. Just incredible.
And it made him the eighth man ever to achieve the career Grand Slam. First to hit $100 million in prize money, set a ranking points record too, 16,950 points, total dominance.
It felt like he was genuinely unbeatable, but then a stumble at Wimbledon, a chink in the armor.
Yeah, that 30-match Grand Slam winning streak, which felt like it would never end, came to a sudden halt. Third-round loss of Wimbledon to Sam Querrey.
Wow, that was unexpected.
Very unexpected. Maybe fatigue, maybe pressure after finally winning Roland Garros.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But it was a setback. He did regroup, though, won his fourth Canadian Open later that year. But that period, culminating in the French Open win, really felt like the peak of that dominant era before new challenges emerged.
That relentless pursuit, that foundation built in adversity, it all led here. Not just to titles, but to forcing this huge conversation. Which, yeah, this is where it gets really interesting. The GOAT debate. Greatest of all time. It's always contentious, always subjective in part. But our sources and the sheer weight of evidence now make a compelling, almost undeniable case for Djokovic.
Yeah, if you connect it to the bigger picture, a lot of people inside the sport, observers, players, coaches, they now openly regard him as the greatest. And it's primarily down to those unprecedented achievements across all the big tournaments, plus that incredible longevity at number one. The stats, especially against his main rivals, are just getting harder and harder to argue against.
And the numbers themselves, when you actually lay them out, they're just staggering. They paint this picture of a uniquely relentless champion. Let's dig into some of that statistical dominance.
Okay, let's start with the biggest ones, Grand Slams.
Mm-hmm.
He holds a men's record, 24 singles titles. He's achieved the triple career Grand Slam, winning each major at least three times. Nobody else has done that in men's tennis.
It's triple career slam. That's insane.
Right. He's the only man to hold all four majors at once. Across three different surfaces, the Knoll Slam.
Hmm.
He's got the career Golden Slam, all four majors, plus Olympic gold, and the career Super Slam, add the year-end championships to that list.
He's basically collected everything.
Pretty much. Four seasons where he won three majors, a record 37 men's major singles finals appearances, 52 semis, 63 quarters, a record 395 match wins at majors, and 14 hardcourt majors alone. It just shows his dominance and consistency on the biggest stages.
And beyond the slams, his ranking records are just mind-boggling. Sustained excellence over such a long period.
Yeah, the weeks at number one. Hmm. Record 428 weeks. Just let that sink in across 13 different years.
13 years he finished ranked number one or spent time there?
He hit that record points total is number one, 16,950. showed how far ahead he was at his peak. And he's the oldest ever world number one at 37. Plus, a record 8 times finishing the year as number one. It's just sustained dominance unlike almost anything we've seen.
And the big titles count slams, masters, year-end finals.
Record 72 big titles. He's completed the big title sweep, won every single one of those elite events at least once. He's a multiple champion at all the annual big titles. Yep. And remember that 2015 season, won 10 big titles in 1 year. Just incredible.
His Master Series record is also off the charts, right? Those 9 big tournaments below the slams.
Completely rewritten the record books there.
Yeah.
Record 40 Masters singles titles. He's done the double career Golden Masters, won all 9 Masters events twice.
Twice. Winning all 9 is hard enough once.
Exactly. Shows incredible mastery across all conditions, all continents. He won 12 Masters finals in a row at one point. Holds the record for Masters match wins, 414, and the ATP finals. Record 7 titles, won them in 3 different decades. That longevity again.
And crucially, he did all this while playing against Federer and Nadal, arguably the 2 other greatest players ever. His head-to-head record is key, isn't it?
It's arguably the most compelling stat in the J-Ed debate for him. He holds a winning record against both Federer, 27-23, and Nadal, 31-29, and against Murray, too, 25-11. He didn't just rack up titles in a weaker era. He beat the best repeatedly. Most wins ever versus top 10 players, 261, versus top 5 players, 125. He's the only player to beat Nadal at all 4 majors. Mm-hmm. Think about beating Rafa at Roland Garros. And he has the most wins over Federer, including 3 Wimbledon finals. That head-to-head dominance against his direct rival is huge.
And the prize money reflects that success, too. All-time leader, over $188 million by 2025. That's a staggering amount of winning. But beyond the numbers, the praise from his peers, from legends of the game, that adds another layer, doesn't it?
It really does. When Rafael Nadal himself says in 2024 that Djokovic's numbers are indisputable and calls him the greatest, acknowledging, quote, "It is not beneath me, nor do I have an ego big enough to try and disguise a reality that is not. This is the truth." That's immense respect from your biggest rival.
Wow. Nadal also said his 2011 level was maybe the highest tennis he'd ever seen.
He did. And back in 2017, Nadal called Djokovic invincible when playing at his best technically. Ultimate praise.
And Medvedev, another rival, just flat out called him the greatest tennis player in history.
Yeah, and Pete Sampras, a GOAT contender himself, pointed to Djokovic's dominance over Fed and Rafa, plus handling the next generation as a clear sign that he is the greatest of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Andre Agassi, who coached him briefly, said, "The highest standard of tennis that I've ever seen is when Novak is playing his best tennis." Coming from Agassi, that means a lot.
What about Nick Bollettieri, the legendary coach? He had strong words too, didn't he?
Bollettieri called him the most complete player ever, the most perfect player of all time.
Yeah.
Said he had no discernible weakness. His quote was something like, "Overall, almost every player has a downfall. To me, he doesn't have one." That's quite the assessment.
And Becker comparing him to Messi, Brady, LeBron, calling him the Lion King of tennis.
Yeah, just placing him among the absolute titans of all sports.
It's overwhelming praise. And those iconic matches really underscore that mental and physical strength everyone talks about, those moments that define him.
Absolutely. You think of that 2012 Aussie Open final against Nadal, the longest major final ever, pure attrition. Or the 2013 Aussie Open fourth round against Wawrinka, that 5-set epic.
The 2018 Wimbledon semi against Nadal, over 2 days, 5 brutal sets.
Pushed both to their absolute limit. And the 2019 Wimbledon final against Federer. Longest Wimbledon final. Saving 2 championship points against the crowd favorite. Unbelievable mental strength.
Even that 2023 Cincinnati final against Alcaraz. Hailed as maybe the best of 3 final ever.
Nearly 4 hours. These matches aren't just wins. They're like defining moments of his resilience, his sheer will to win. They show you what he's made of.
Okay, so with all these achievements, the stats, the praise,
yeah,
what does it actually look like on court? What defines his playing style that allows him to be so dominant?
Yeah, what makes him tick, technically and tactically?
Mm-hmm.
He's often called one of the most complete athletes ever, and his game reflects that. He has this incredible ability to turn defense into offense almost instantly. Fundamentally, he's an aggressive baseliner. His ground strokes, both wings, are incredibly consistent, deep, penetrating. He just suffocates opponents from the back of the court.
And that two-handed backhand, it's legendary, right? Maybe the best ever.
It's widely considered the greatest two-hander of all time, yeah. It's just so effective. Accurate, powerful, versatile. He can open up the court cross-court, but that backhand down the line, hit with pace and precision. It's a killer shot. A real weapon, very hard to read and counter.
But often it's the return of serve that people point to as the difference maker, especially against the other greats. How does he do it?
Yeah, his return is a massive weapon. Agassi called it the precedent-setting standard. He's just incredibly efficient at getting returns back deep, with pace, off both sides. He neutralizes big serves right from the first shot. He doesn't just chip it back. He often uses the return to immediately put the server under pressure.
Todd Martin said it was way better than any other return ever.
He did. High praise from a former coach. Huh. He can be offensive with it, defensive with it. Just consistently gets balls back in play and turns the tables.
What about the forehand? Is it overshadowed by the backhand, or is it just as crucial?
It's maybe underrated, but still one of the best out there. Very versatile. He uses it to dictate play, finish points, especially off short balls. It's a really solid, reliable shot. And his serve, after some tweaks earlier in his career, became a real weapon too. Lots of free points.
Flat first serves for power, slice, and kick seconds.
Typically, yeah. Hits the spots well. Uses the slice serve out wide effectively, especially on the ad court, to open things up.
All that technique, combined with his physical gifts, he must just feel like a wall that can suddenly attack you.
That's a good way to put it. He's renowned for his fitness, his completeness as an athlete, incredible agility, court coverage, mobility. He hits winners from positions that look impossible. His flexibility, the sliding on hard courts. He rarely gets aced, gets to almost everything.
And that under pressure rating stat he leads, winning deciding sets, ties back to that childhood pressure.
He thinks so, yeah. That ability to deliver when it matters most, time after time.
Yeah.
It's maybe his defining trait, just clutch.
So it's not just hitting hard, it's thinking smart too. Any specific tactical tricks he uses?
Oh, he's incredibly astute tactically. Yeah. He uses that well-disguised backhand drop shot beautifully to break rhythm and draw opponents in. Uses the slice backhand effectively too for defense or just changing the pace.
Jimmy Connors had that interesting observation back in 2011.
Yeah, Connors said he played a little bit old school, taking the ball early, on the rise, driving it flat, which lets him absorb opponents' heavy topspin and redirect it. Turn their power into his offense. It's a very sophisticated, adaptable game. Power play strategy.
And to execute all that, you need the right gear. What's he been using over the years? Rackets? Shoes?
His racket journey is interesting. Started with head, briefly used a custom Wilson painted to look like a head, then went back to head for good. Used various models like the UTEC Speed Pro, Graphene Speed Pro. Lots of marketing around those.
And the strings, a hybrid setup.
Yeah, typically head natural gut in the mains for feel, and Luxlon ALU power rough in the crosses for control and spin. A common pro setup. Shoes famously wore those custom red and blue Adidas barricades for the Serbian flag colors. Switched to ASICs in 2018, known for stability.
Gotcha. And behind this incredible long career, there's always a team. Who were the key people supporting him? Coaches? Trainers?
Foundational coaches were Jelena Gemicic, 93-99, and Nikola Pilic, 99-03, as we mentioned. His longest and most successful partnership was clearly with Marijan Vajda. Coached him from 2006 to 2017, then they reunited in 2018 before splitting again amicably in 2022. Vajda was a constant presence.
He worked with some other big names too, didn't he, for shorter periods?
Yeah, specialist coaches like Mark Woodford briefly in 07, Todd Martin in 09-10, even Andre Agassi for a bit in 2017. And most recently, that surprise stint with Andy Murray coaching him from late 2024 to May 2025.
That was unexpected. What about the physical side? Physios, fitness coaches, crucial for his longevity.
Absolutely essential. Physio Miljan Amadovic has been with him a long time. Fitness coaches like Gebhard, Phil Grish, and Marco Panici have been key to maintaining that incredible physical condition. And then there's the nutritionist, Igor Idoyevich, who joined in 2010.
The gluten intolerance discovery, right?
Yeah.
That seems pivotal.
Widely credited with it, yeah. Reportedly used applied kinesiology. That dietary change going gluten-free is seen by many, including Djokovic, as a massive turning point for his endurance and health. His longtime agents managed his business side, Eduardo Artoldi and Elena Capiaro, then big agencies like CAA and IMG, a whole infrastructure.
Okay, so beyond the court, beyond the titles and the training, there's this whole other dimension to Djokovic, his philanthropy, his business interests, his personal views. Let's unpack that side. His commitment to giving back seems really significant.
It really does. He's incredibly active as a philanthropist, and it feels deeply rooted in his own challenging upbringing. He started the Novak Djokovic Foundation back in 2007. Its main focus is supporting kids from disadvantaged communities, especially in Serbia, focusing on early childhood education.
And they've had a real impact, haven't they? Building schools.
A huge impact. built 50 schools, working on the 51st now, supported over 20,800 children, 1,000 families. That's sustained concrete work over many years.
That's really impressive. And he's got that global recognition, too, like the UNICEF role.
Yeah, appointed a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador in 2015. He's done loads of charity matches for disaster relief, Haiti earthquake, Queensland floods, Avila Tower reconstruction. And remember that 2014 Rome Masters win donated the entire $500,000 prize to flood victims in Serbia. His foundation raised another $600K on top of that.
Wow.
Donated to Melbourne City Mission in 2016. And during COVID in 2020, he and his wife donated €1 million for ventilators and gear in Serbia, plus donations to Italy and other parts of the region, led to him winning the Arthur Ashe Humanitarian Award in 2012. It's clearly a massive part of who he is.
And like most top athletes, he's built a significant business portfolio too. Sponsorships, ventures.
Oh yeah, big endorsements over the years. Clothing. Adidas, then Sergio Tacchini famously ended because they couldn't afford his win bonuses.
Too successful for a sponsor.
Basically. Then Uniqlo, and since 2017, Lacoste. Shoes were Adidas Barricades, now ASICS. Luxury deals with Audemars Piguet watches, Mercedes-Benz, Peugeot, Seiko watches. Was a Learjet ambassador for Bombardier.
Wide range. Banking, wine.
Yep. ANZ Bank, Jacobs Creek Wine, had that Made By film series with him. Telecom Serbija, Fitline Supplements, Raiffeisen Bank, UKG Workforce Management. A diverse portfolio reflecting his global reach.
And his family runs some businesses too, extending the brand.
Yeah, through their company Family Sport, they had the Novak Cafe and restaurant chain in Serbia and Bosnia. And significantly, they bought the ATP tournament in the Netherlands in 2009 and moved it to Belgrade, creating the Serbia Open. Ran until 2012. Brought top tennis home.
He's had personal ventures too, right? Food products, restaurants.
Launched Joko Life Nutritional Food Products in 2015. Opened a vegan restaurant, Ekita, in Monte Carlo in 2016, though it closed in 2019. Shows that strong interest in health and wellness carrying over.
And some interesting investments outside of tennis. Biotech, football.
Holds a big stake, 80%. In a biotech firm, Quant Biores. They claim to be developing a COVID drug based on electromagnetic frequency. Our sources note this approach is considered scientifically dubious, kind of likened to homeopathy, diverging from standard scientific principles. It reflects his interest in alternative approaches.
Right, and more recently, co-owning a football club.
Yeah, Lones FC in France's League Two since August 2025, venturing into team ownership.
He's also taken a stand on players' rights within tennis, hasn't he, with the PTPA?
That's right. Resigned from the ATP Player Council in 2020, co-founded the Professional Tennis Players Association with Vasek Pospisil. The idea is to give players, especially lower-ranked ones, a stronger voice, more influence, push for better prize money distribution. It was a bold move, challenging the established structure.
His personality has also made a mark, sometimes in surprising ways. Those impersonations early in his career were huge.
Oh, they were hilarious and incredibly accurate. His Sharapova, Nadal, Federer, Roddick, they went viral back in 2007. He even did them on court at the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
Showed this really lighthearted, funny side that endeared him to a lot of fans early on.
He's clearly had a massive cultural impact, especially back home in Serbia.
Huge. He, along with Ivanovic and Jankovic, really sparked a tennis boom there. He's done Eurovision appearances, talk shows like Leno, Conan, Ellen. Was in a Martin Solvang music video.
Ah, really?
Yep. Got awarded the Order of Serbian National Defense, had nearly 100,000 people welcome him in Belgrade after his first Wimbledon win, named one of Time's 100 most influential people in 2012. His reach is global.
And he's even inspired scientists to name creatures after him. That's unique.
It is. A freshwater snail, Travuniana Djokovici, in 2021. And a beetle, Duvalius Djokovici, in 2022. Fun tributes. He was also in that Federer documentary in 2024, first man on the cover of Vogue Adria, cover of the tiebreak video game, still very much in the public eye across different platforms.
Okay, now we need to get into a really pivotal and often debated part of his story, his personal views on diet, medicine, science, particularly around the COVID-19 vaccine. This had huge consequences for him.
Yeah, and this raises that complex question about individual freedom versus public health mandates. Our sources are clear. His stance wasn't anti all vaccines, but specifically against forced vaccination. And this stance led him to make some incredibly difficult career-impacting choices, rooted in long-held beliefs about his own body and health.
Let's start with the diet. Famously strict.
Super strict. Linked to that nutritionist, Adievich, and the alleged gluten intolerance discovery via applied kinesiology, Djokovic fully credits going gluten-free for transforming his endurance, getting rid of fatigue and allergies. He eventually adopted a largely vegan diet, sometimes eats fish, believes it cured allergies and mild asthma. Diet is absolutely core to his regime.
And he's openly skeptical of conventional medicine, especially surgery.
Very much so. Publicly stated, he's not a fan of surgeries or medications, believes the body is a self-healing mechanism.
Oh.
That story about him crying for 3 days after his elbow surgery in 2018 because he felt guilty about intervening medically. It shows how deep that belief runs.
Our sources also mention some beliefs described as scientifically dubious. Can you unpack that carefully, just presenting the info?
Sure. In his 2013 book, Serve to Win, he wrote about an anecdote where a researcher supposedly changed water's appearance just by directing emotions at it, anger making it green, love keeping it clear. And in 2020, he spoke about believing prayer and gratitude could turn toxic food or polluted water into healing water, claiming scientists have proven water molecules react to emotions. Our sources label these claims scientifically dubious, generally seen as superstitious. The idea water molecules react to human emotion to gain healing properties contradicts basic chemistry and physics. It highlights a worldview that diverges significantly from mainstream science.
And this personal philosophy really collided with the world during the pandemic, specifically regarding the COVID-19 vaccine mandates. This cost him dearly.
It absolutely did. He signaled opposition to forced vaccination back in April 2020. He clarified later it wasn't anti-all vaccines, but anti-mandate, emphasizing extreme care about what goes into his body. His unvaccinated status led directly to his visa cancellation and deportation from Australia before the 2022 Australian Open. Big global news story.
And it meant he couldn't play in the U.S. either for a while, missed the U.S. Open.
Correct. U.S. entry restrictions for unvaccinated non-citizens meant he missed Indian Wells, Miami, and the U.S. Open in 2022.
That's potentially multiple majors he missed out on. Choosing his principles over chasing records shows incredibly strong conviction.
Exactly. He explicitly said he was willing to forgo tournaments, even if it cost him records and his GOAT status, because of his principles and belief in personal freedom of choice. He also made a point of saying he doesn't associate with the wider anti-vax movement, framing it purely as individual autonomy over his own body, a stance he held despite massive scrutiny and professional cost.
Beyond those health views, his faith is also clearly very important to him, isn't it?
Deeply important. He's a devout member of the Serbian Orthodox Church, baptized back in 92. He received the Order of St. Sava, the highest honor from the Serbian Orthodox Church, for his contributions to monasteries in Kosovo and his charity work. Faith is central. Interestingly, he also meditates daily, often at the Buddhist Buddha Padipa Temple near Wimbledon, seeking serenity. Visits meditation sites in Bosnia, too. Suggests a spiritual openness, perhaps.
He also seems comfortable blending sport with political or cultural statements, especially about Serbia and the region.
Definitely. He supports Serbian teams like Red Star, but also international clubs like AC Milan, Benfica. Broader sports fan. Significantly, he supported Croatia in the 2018 World Cup, which raised eyebrows given the history. But he framed it as sports uniting people, overcoming differences. Praised Luka Modric.
And then there was that statement at the French Open in 2023. The writing on the camera lens.
Yes, that caused quite a stir. After a first-round win, he wrote, "Kosovo is the heart of Serbia. Stop the violence," responding to clashes there. He defended it strongly, saying he felt he had to support our people and Serbia, called Kosovo our cradle, our stronghold. It showed that deep, unwavering connection to his homeland's identity and complex history, even on a global stage like Roland Garros.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, Novak Djokovic.
No.
It's clear his legacy is just incredibly intricate, isn't it? Like that backhand complex, powerful multi-layer from that tough childhood to becoming this statistical force of nature, a philanthropist, a businessman, a figure of really strong, sometimes controversial, but always deeply held beliefs. He's truly unique.
Totally unique. His story isn't just about the trophies. It's about resilience. It's about conviction and navigating the glare of modern fame while staying true, it seems, to his own compass. And maybe if we connected to the bigger picture, given that unwavering commitment to personal freedom, to his idea of well-being, even when it meant sacrificing potential records, what does his career ultimately teach us about that intersection of personal belief, intense athletic drive, and how it all plays out under intense public scrutiny today? It's a fascinating question that goes way beyond just tennis, doesn't it? Leaves you with a lot to think about.